It's Hail Mary time. The Trump legal team has thrown a Hail Mary pass by filing a lawsuit on behalf of the state of Texas and other states against other states for original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court. Creative, but a real Hail Mary. Probably too little, probably too late. And maybe I'm throwing a Hail Mary myself. I'm trying desperately to save, along with others, to save the life of Brandon Bernard, this young man who is about to be executed tomorrow for a crime, a capital crime, of which he is probably innocent. But Hail Marys sometimes work. And if you believe that justice is on your side, you have to throw these Hail Mary passes. You'll hear why on The Dirt Show. The president's team lost one in the Supreme Court yesterday, but then they also filed a very interesting, creative lawsuit by the state of Texas against several other states. Very, very interesting development. Unlikely to succeed. A Hail Mary, but really worth discussing. So let's go over both of those issues now so you're brought up to date. Yesterday, of course, was the final day under the safe harbor provision, and enough states have now certified the election to make Joe Biden the president elect in every sense other than the December 14th actual day of voting. But let's talk about both Pennsylvania and Texas. In the Pennsylvania case, the Supreme Court simply rejected an application for injunctive relief to stop the state from certifying the election prior to the safe harbor deadline. That was not surprising. I think we all anticipated that would happen. It's rare that the Supreme Court grants an injunction in a situation like that. They still have opened the possibility of taking the case on the merits after the safe harbor provision has expired. But I think probably the fact that they turned it down with no opinion, just a one-line order, suggests that probably the Pennsylvania case will not be accepted by the Supreme Court, not because it lacks legal merit. It has substantial legal merit, but because the numbers aren't there, but because the challenged ballots don't seem to exceed the margin of victory that Biden had over Trump. And that would make a victory in the case for the Trump people, a legal victory, a Pyrrhic victory. And it would really put the Supreme Court in the business of not deciding real cases and controversies, but giving advisory opinions. So, as I've said from the very beginning, although the law and the justices may agree that the state of Pennsylvania did not act properly under Article 2 of the Constitution by allowing its courts to extend the time for receiving ballots 3 days beyond what the legislature had done, that the reality is that the numbers aren't there and the lawsuit may have come too late. The courts have also been saying, well, wait a minute, why did you wait so long? Why did you wait until you saw what the results of the election were? Why didn't you file suits before? You knew before this that the legislature had done one thing and the courts had done another thing. You knew that there were going to be a write-in ballots. You knew all of these things that you're now complaining about. Why did you wait until after the election results were in? We, the courts, find it hard to disenfranchise voters who've already voted and to undo the results of an election. So too little, too late, not enough votes, and you're out of court. That's what the courts have been holding. So now we come to Texas. I have to tell you, these lawyers deserve an A-plus for creativity. The idea actually was originated by a friend of mine named Nathan Lewin, a great lawyer in Washington, D.C. We kind of grew up together, and we've known each other for years and years and years. We argued a case in the Supreme Court together, I would say, in 1969. My God, talk about ancient history. Nat Lewin is one of the great lawyers of our generation, and he's also taught at Columbia, and he's taught at Harvard Law School, and he's lectured all over the country, and he's argued many, many cases in front of the Supreme Court. He's the one who originally came up with the idea that a state can sue another state in the Supreme Court and have original jurisdiction. What does original jurisdiction mean? It means you don't have to go through a trial. You don't have to go through an intermediate court of appeals. You actually file the suit in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court acts as a trial court. It can hear evidence. It can cross-examine witnesses. It renders a verdict. So I'll read you the provision of the Constitution. It says, in all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and councils, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. But that turned out to be a mistake, because what happened shortly after that constitutional provision was enacted, a guy sued Georgia and brought it in the Supreme Court. And Georgia said, wait a minute, does this mean any individual can sue anybody? Can sue a state? Any individual can sue a state and just get the case in front of the Supreme Court? Supreme Court's going to be just totally filled with cases in which individuals sue states. And what about sovereign immunity? And what about all of those issues? And so right after they enacted the Bill of Rights, which is really part of the Constitution, the next amendment to the Constitution, Amendment Number 11, clarified that, or really changed it. And it said the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit commenced or prosecuted against one of the states by citizens of another state or by citizens or subject of any foreign state. So, and then Congress passed the Judiciary Act. And the Judiciary Act makes it very clear that if one state sues another state, for example, remember New York and New Jersey had a dispute. Who owns the Statue of Liberty? Very interesting. It's, you know, it's in the middle. It's in the water between New York and New Jersey. New Jersey said, hey, it's closer to us. They were right. New York said, it may be closer to you, but, you know, our people really built it. And most of the people who visit come from New York. It's our Statue of Liberty. So that's a perfect example of a case in which one state sues another, and New Jersey won. The Statue of Liberty now belongs to Jersey, not Staten Island or Brooklyn, where it's closer to. Terrible, terrible decision. I still think Brooklyn should own the Statue of Liberty. In any event, that's what original jurisdiction is about. So you might think that this case will actually result in a trial in front of the Supreme Court with witnesses and, you know, maybe court for TV, made for TV court. It'll be on television. You'll see witnesses. Finally, you'll hear Clarence Thomas maybe questioning some people. No, no, no. That's not the way it works. Although it says original jurisdiction, what the Supreme Court does in the few cases it gets, it had a case a few years ago where two states, I think Colorado and I don't remember, argued about who owned a river, who controlled a river that was halfway between both states. That case took about more than a decade to decide, because what the Supreme Court did is it appointed a master, a former judge or a distinguished lawyer, to become the trial judge, basically. And that lawyer conducted the trial, heard the witnesses, cross-examination, and then issued a report to the Supreme Court. And the justices took the report as gospel, the way judges take the reports of the trial courts in regular cases, and decided the case on the law based on the facts as established by this monitor or this referee. And so that's likely to happen, but that takes time. As I said, this case involving Colorado took more than 10 years, and there is no time. The 14th is when the electors vote and decide who the next president's going to be. Again, remember, there's been no presidential election yet. All we've had so far is the election of electors. The president is elected on the day designated by Congress. It's not in the Constitution. The only thing in the Constitution is January 20th at noon. The presidency ends, but Congress has established the 14th this year. Every year it's a little different because it's a Wednesday following a Tuesday or something like that. And on the 14th, the electors will meet and will elect Joe Biden as president of the United States. And there won't be time between now and then for there to be a trial in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court is not going to grant an injunction. It's not going to tell the electors not to vote. It's not going to grant a stay of any kind. The election will go forward. But you have to give these lawyers a credit for coming up with this idea. It is consistent with the Constitution. The problem is the theory what happened is a very, very speculative theory. Here's the way it goes. The state of Texas, and some other states are joining it now, are arguing that the citizens of Texas, the people of Texas, were denied their constitutional rights by the fact that the people of Michigan who voted didn't have their votes counted properly. Here, the argument goes something like this. Look, If thousands or hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of votes in Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, you name it, if those votes were improperly counted, if fraudulent votes were counted, if votes were shifted, if people who voted for Biden shouldn't have been allowed to vote, then the impact of the voters in Texas is diminished, because for every fraudulent vote counted, the vote of a legitimate voter counts less. That's the theory. So the theory is that Texas has standing, has the right to represent the people of its state who lost some of their power because the people of other states had votes counted that shouldn't have been counted. Hail Mary. But remember, if you watched football 3 weeks ago, the Hail Murray pass that won the game in the last second, a jump ball in the end zone or near the end zone caught by a great receiver. Hail Marys sometimes work. So I don't blame the lawyers for trying everything. My former colleague Larry Tribe, you know, said it was one of the stupidest arguments he ever heard in his life. Well, I have to tell you, folks, I know Larry Tribe. If the shoe were on the other foot, if it were his candidate and his party who had lost the election in a close way, he, Professor Tribe, would be coming up with this argument. He'd be saying it's the most brilliant creative argument since the dawn of time. He's always doing that. He's always condemning arguments that he himself would be making if the shoe were on the other foot. If the dictionary had the word hypocrite, and it was an illustrated dictionary, right over the word hypocrite, there would be a picture, not only of Larry Tribe, but of other of my former friends and colleagues who have condemned arguments made on behalf of President Trump that they would have made had the shoe been on the other foot. Had Hillary Clinton been elected president and impeached, Tribe would have been up there in the Senate making exactly the same arguments that I made and calling them brilliant and asking everybody to accept them. And many scholars would be shaking their heads and saying, wow, what a brilliant argument. But because I made it on behalf of President Trump, oh, that was a silly argument. How could anybody expect that argument to be taken seriously? You know, hypocrisy has become so common, so frequent among American academics particularly, but the media as well, that it's the currency of the realm, and you don't know what to believe. You don't know who to take seriously. Well, you can take seriously what I say on The Durst Show, because I have never made an argument that I would not have been proud to make had the shoe been on the other foot. I always make arguments that I would make on either side, principled arguments that work. And if the shoe been on the other foot, I would say about this argument involving Texas, it's a clever argument, it's a creative argument, A plus for creativity, but it won't work. It won't work because there's not enough time. It won't work because the argument itself, as distinguished from bringing a case to the Supreme Court, is a matter of original jurisdiction. That's very clever. But the argument itself that the votes of Texans are diminished by how votes were counted in Michigan is just far too much of a stretch. And I think the Supreme Court would also say you should have brought the case earlier. You waited too long. The election was on November 3rd. We're now in close to the middle of December. Too little, too late. Speaking about the middle of December, tomorrow is the day when the person I talked about yesterday, this young African-American man on death row, is scheduled to be executed. A black man being executed for his involvement in the murder of two white people. That's unfortunately the common way in which executions are carried out in the United States. When a black person kills a white person, much, much more likely to get the death penalty than when a white person kills a black person, or when a white person kills a white person, or a black person kills a black person. When you have a black person killing white person or persons, that's the most likely combination of factors that results in the death penalty. So race does, without a doubt, play a role on both sides of the equation. If the defendant is black, more likely to be on death row. If the victims are white, the defendant's more likely to be on death row if the defendant is black. So race does play a role. But that's not the main reason why there should be a commutation in this case. The reason why President Trump should commute the sentence of Brandon Bernard has not really to do with race. There are so many other factors. He probably is innocent of any capital crime. The way I view the evidence now, it is much more likely that the victim was dead at the time that Brandon Bernard poured the gas on the car and lit it on fire. He did a terrible, terrible thing. He destroyed evidence. He destroyed bodies. He should remain in prison for those crimes for as long as people get sentences for crimes like that. But he didn't pull the trigger. He didn't kill them. We have no evidence that he intended for them to die. There's no evidence that he knew that one of them might conceivably have been alive. Remember who has the burden of proof. The state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the victim was alive. And the fact that there was some soot in her lungs doesn't prove that. It may prove that she had a response after dying. As I said yesterday, when you cut off the head of a chicken, it will walk around for a couple of seconds. We know that when people die, their nails and their hair continue to grow. Death is a process. And when a woman is shot in the head at close range, in the brain, she's medically dead. There's no chance that she could be revived. And there was no chance that she could have felt any pain or knew what was going on. So by any moral and probably medical criteria, she was dead. And the government failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was alive. Why? Because the defense didn't put on a medical expert who could contradict the expert on the other side who said, well, there was soot in her lung, therefore she must have been alive. So that's one very, very strong reason. The other is that he's not a murderer. He is an accessory to a murder. And the death penalty should be reserved for the worst criminals, people who are actually the murderers. And the man who pulled the trigger in this case has been executed. There has been an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. We know that President Trump is determined to see that victims get justice and that people who deserve the death penalty get executed. I'm not quarreling with that at this point in time. I am quarreling with the fact that this is not the right person to execute. Executing this person who was 18 and who has for 22 years been a model prisoner, teaching other young people to stay away from trouble. He's the wrong person to execute. The United States will execute only a small number of people over the next few years. And if they're going to execute anybody, they should pick the worst of the worst of the worst. This man does not fit those criteria. He had a less than a constitutionally effective lawyer. Many mistakes were made in the trial. Evidence was kept from the jury. Four of the jurors have said themselves that they would not have voted for the death penalty had they known what they know now. One of the prosecutors in the case who justified the death penalty now says he shouldn't be executed. I am told, I don't know for sure, that even the Justice Department has not urged the execution. They've taken no position, and others within the Justice Department have said that commutation might be proper. The problem is it's been very hard to get to President Trump on this. I know Kim Kardashian, who has been very active in trying to prevent this execution, has tried her best to get to the president. Maybe you can do what Kim Kardashian can't do. Maybe you can get to the president. Maybe you can write to him, email him, call the White House, say this is not the right case for execution. So this is a day in which we have to look backward and look forward. Looking forward, I think we have to assume that on the 14th of December, the electors will elect Joe Biden to be the president of the United States. Looking backward, we have to say we could have done a little better on this election. We could have made sure, in anticipation of the election, that all Americans would be satisfied with the, not necessarily the result, but the process. That's why I have proposed the establishment for the future of a voter integrity panel, VIP, consisting of VIPs, very important people, former judges, presidents of universities, priests, rabbis, ministers, people who are beyond reproach, people who are nonpartisan, who could serve as a panel before whom can be brought any claim of electoral misfunction before the election, during the election, after the election. I remember so vividly on Election Day 2000 getting a call from a rabbi in Palm Beach, Florida, at about noontime, saying, "Alan," I knew the rabbi from, he had been in Boston previously, "Alan, there's something going on in this election that's terrible. My voters, my Jewish voters are coming back telling me that they accidentally voted for Pat Buchanan because the butterfly ballot was organized wrong. The hole was in the wrong place, and they thought they were voting for Gore Lieberman. They ended up voting for Pat Buchanan, and thereby hundreds and hundreds, maybe more, votes were disqualified that should have gone for Gore and Lieberman, and those votes would have been enough to make them president and vice president of the United States." That was at about noontime. If this voter integrity panel existed, the matter could be brought to their attention and maybe even cured by 2 or 3 in the afternoon. People could have then continued at least to vote the proper way, or other remedies could have been engaged in, or somebody could have looked at the ballot before the election and seen that the butterfly ballot was wrong and bring it to the attention of this panel. So for the future, I think we can do better. I think we can have processes in place that don't rely on the media, which you cannot rely on, and don't rely on partisans. You know, if you believe partisans and you believe the media, there are only two alternatives. Either there were no fraud in this election and no miscounted votes, it was a perfect election, totally false, of course it wasn't, we've never had such an election, or the other claim on the other side is every aspect of the election was fraudulent and nothing was correct and nothing was proper, and that doesn't seem correct either. It's in the middle. There were some fraudulent ballots, there always are. There were some people who were dead who were voted. There were some people who probably came from different states and voted improperly. There probably were some people who voted twice, once by mail-in and once in person. That always happens in elections. But what were the numbers? That's the crucial thing. Was there anything systemic? Was there anybody at the top who said, "Hey, let's turn this election around. Let's fix the machine so that they spew out the votes that were intended for Trump and give them to Biden"? Those are the kinds of issues that a voter integrity panel could look into. So those are the issues for today: voter integrity, creativity, hypocrisy, and the death penalty. And I have to tell you, I am not sleeping as long as I know that this young man is facing a lethal injection tomorrow, one day. I will try everything I can today. I will devote all day today, as I did yesterday, in trying to reach the right people and trying to persuade them that this is the wrong decision. This is not a decision that's good for justice. It's not good for law enforcement. It's not good for anybody. Even the victim's relatives, who normally cry out for justice and did cry out for justice for the trigger man, the man who killed their children, and their relatives, as far as I've been told, they have remained silent about this man because he was only an accessory. And he, yes, burned the bodies and he deserves to be punished, but he was not the trigger man. He was not the killer. And so, Mr. President, I hope you will take time out of your incredibly busy schedule. Take a call from me, from Kim Kardashian. Look at the record in the case. Make a decision that even though you want to go forward with death penalties in some cases, this is not the right case. Look, Barack Obama had an opportunity to save this man's life and didn't do it. Show you're a bigger person than Barack Obama. Show that you can do what he wouldn't do. Show that that you can have justice with mercy. Show that you understand the biblical command, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice, must you pursue. Justice repeated twice. One, firm justice, according to the law, and the second, justice, compassionate justice, according to the circumstances and facts of each particular case. This man deserves compassionate justice. So please make your voices known to the White House. And you can tell them that you're calling at my suggestion. You can tell them you're calling because you believe it. And I'm glad that we devoted a couple of sessions of the Dirt Show to trying to achieve this kind of justice with mercy. Let's now turn to your questions on the Dirt Show. Our first call is from a repeat caller, Ruvain.
I just wanted to follow up. You had mentioned that Brandon Bernard only arrived at the scene after the two victims were already dead. According to an article I read in the Indy Star, they say that Brandon was involved in the crime even before the two were dead, and that he had started pouring the lighter fluid all over the car even before the victims were shot. He was pouring the lighter fluid over the car as the victims were praying. Then the other person went and shot them. So he was, according to this article, if it's correct, he was actually there while they were alive. They were shot in his presence. He had already started pouring the lighter fluid. And then he lit the car on fire. So even if they were both dead from the gunshot wound and his burning the car did not result in their death, but shouldn't he be able to be killed because of the felony murder rule?
That's a great question. My knowledge of the facts is slightly different from yours. Yes, he was there, as I understand it. At the time the shots were fired, he had no control over the shooter. The shooter killed these two people in cold blood. But my understanding is that then the shooter turned to him and said, pour gasoline. And by the time he poured the gasoline and lit the flames, both of them had been shot in the head and both of them were medically dead. You're right. The felony murder rule does cover this, but that's not what we're focusing on. We're focusing on the issue of compassion, of whether a man who was just over the age of 18, remember the two people who were just under the age of 18, got prison terms and they're out, they're back with their families. The adult, the man who was over 18, who fired the fatal shots, has been executed. The question is, should a guy who was in an intermediate situation, yes, he poured the fluid on the car and lit it on fire, according to what I understand, he believed that they were dead at the time. And again, the burden of proof's on the state. The state had to prove that these folks were alive. Even if they alleged it, and I don't believe they did, they had to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think this case, that proof hasn't been established. But even if you think it has been, it's still a case for compassion because of his age, because of the fact that jurors who sentenced him to death have said that if they heard all the evidence, and their assessment of the evidence is different than yours and more consistent with mine, if they had heard all the evidence, they would not have voted for the death penalty. That, to me, is one of the most significant factors in why compassion is necessary. The government withheld from the jurors evidence that would have changed the mind of four jurors. That, to me, is enough to warrant compassion and a decision by the president to commute the sentence to life imprisonment. Our next question is from Jim in Minnesota.
Hello, Alan. This is Jim Nelson from Ramsey, Minnesota. I'm sure you have a statue of the Scales of Justice, the lady holding the scales. She's wearing a blindfold. Could you expound on what she's blind to? The list of things that she is not looking at when she's incurring justice, and contrast that to what's happening, I think, in Seattle regarding criminals who are poor or of color or whatever they're doing there, and also contrast to where the justice originates from, and I'm assuming it's biblical, to not give favor to the poor. Thank you.
Oh, what a great question. I used to have in my office at Harvard a cartoon of Lady Justice with the blindfold, but her peeking a little bit to see who the defendant was, who the lawyers were. Obviously, when we talk about blind justice, we don't want justice to be blind to relevant facts. We want them to be blind to irrelevant facts. You're absolutely right. It comes directly from the Bible, the book of Deuteronomy, where the laws are set out. It happened to be my bar mitzvah portion where I read from the Torah, the portion called Shoftim, the one that says, justice, justice must you seek. And it also sets out rules for judges. And the rules require that there be no favoritism for the wealthy or for the poor, and do not put stumbling blocks in front of the blind, and do absolute justice. But again, justice, justice. So it includes justice with compassion. And I think what a lot of judges say is they should keep their blinders on during the trial. But once the trial is over and it comes to sentencing, they should take their blinders off. And they should look wholly at the individual, the totality of the circumstances. So there is a time for justice, blind justice, and there is a time for compassion, compassionate justice. And I think in the Brandon Bernard case, the time has come for compassionate justice. Thanks for a great call. Our next call is from Mike.
In regards to your statement about the decriminalization of marijuana, I'm very much on your side with this. I believe it should be decriminalized. I am not a marijuana user personally, but I have friends who are totally honorable and productive members of society who do. And in return, they actually don't drink. So that's their preferred vice, if you will. My only caveat to that, and I'm a hard stance on it, we need to have a way to determine, as you said, is someone under the influence of marijuana when they are operating machinery or driving a vehicle or anything along those lines? And I mean, no, in the instant, something that can be done in the field to determine that, or at least close to the field. We have the breathalyzer for alcohol. To my knowledge, nothing exists to determine marijuana use in people. And the tests for marijuana use that are done in people, the hair and blood, things like that, can determine if it's been used in the last few days, which is useless. If somebody smoked yesterday, they went to bed, they've been, you know, hadn't had anything for hours and hours and hours, and then drive a car and get in a wreck, and then they get tested, and all of a sudden it says, oh, no, you have it in your system, but they didn't. It had been well through their system. That's a problem as well. So the only hard stance on that is we have to have a way to test instantly in the field and conveniently to see if someone's under a current influence of marijuana for the safety of the public. Thanks.
What a great point. I tend to agree with the main thrust of your argument. Yes, marijuana should be legalized. No, people should not be allowed to drive under the influence of marijuana, alcohol, barbiturates, anything else that could create unsafe conditions for not only the person but his potential victims on the road. I don't know the science or the technology about whether we could develop a technique for detecting instantaneously whether you're under the influence of marijuana. I suspect it's not beyond the realm of possibilities. You mentioned the 2 or 3 day test for other substances. I actually won a case based on that some years ago. The issue in the case was whether the accuser of my client, who testified under oath that she had never used cocaine, was telling the truth. And we wanted to get a hold of her hair so that we could test her hair. And the longer your hair, I think the more likely you can find evidence of prior cocaine use. And when this woman, the accuser, found out that we were trying to get her hair, she immediately ran downstairs, went to the first barbershop, a men's barbershop, and had virtually all of her hair cut off. We found out about that, and we actually sent an investigator to the barbershop to see if we could retrieve her hair. We could not. But the fact that she did that became pretty strong evidence that she had something to hide and that she hadn't told the truth about her cocaine use. And I know of other cases where the hair was examined and evidence of cocaine was used either to prosecute or in some instances to defend against false witnesses. So the technology is very important, but I think we agree on the principle that marijuana should be treated much like alcohol is treated. And if we can develop a test for being under the influence of marijuana, it would move that along very nicely and create a situation where marijuana and alcohol were treated in a similar fashion. So great idea. Thanks for your terrific call. Let's turn now to our next caller.
Professor Dershowitz, you seriously think Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize? What kind of bad drugs are you on? I mean, seriously, what the fuck? You're a fucking Shonda. What the hell happened to you? Forget you. Goodbye.
Well, first of all, let me assure you, I'm not on any drugs. I did have a cup of decaffeinated coffee this morning. That's my drug of choice. I don't use caffeine. I've never had a drug in my life. So you can't blame the drugs. You have to blame me directly. And I stand by my position that the Nobel Peace Prize should be given to the person or persons who contributed most to peace in the criteria under the will of Alfred Nobel. And those criteria would cover the Abraham Accords. And again, thank you for your call, but I wish you had come up with reasoned argument against it instead of just cursing. So next time, call back, curse if you'd like, but come up with a reasoned argument. I'd like to hear what the arguments are against presenting a prize to somebody who accomplished more than any previous president in terms of helping Israel and the Arab states come together without war and in peace and with normality. So thanks for your call. Our next call is from Dennis.
Hello, Professor Dershowitz. My name is Dennis. I'm a conservative and a Republican, so I disagree with you on most of the issues, but I do respect you for your intellectual honesty and the consistent way that you make your judgments. I want to encourage you to nominate President Trump. I feel that when President Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize, before he actually did anything, it made the prize look like it was a partisan institution. And I think that if you, a respected Democrat, were to nominate President Trump, it would show that the Nobel Peace Prize is above partisan politics. All right, thank you.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's a reasoned argument for Trump getting the Nobel Peace Prize. I'd like to hear reasoned arguments against it. We've had some on this show, but just cursing and yelling doesn't make the cut. There are arguments in favor. There are arguments against. I think the arguments in favor outweigh the arguments against. Do I think he will get the Nobel Peace Prize? No, because I think the committee that selects the Nobel Peace Prize has generally been biased in one direction rather than the other. And so I think it will be futile, but I do things based on principle, and I appreciate your call. You've given me some very good and strong principled arguments to take into consideration before I make my decision. Thanks. Our next call is from Toronto. Adam?
Hey, my name is Adam. I'm from Toronto, Canada. And answering your question about vaccines, I don't think the government has the right to force someone to take the vaccine if it doesn't help public health. If the government can't ban cigarettes, harmful foods, and other activities that lead to cancer or other diseases, which drain the healthcare system, I don't think it'd be right for them to make vaccines mandatory. I'd also like to hear what arguments you'd make for and against mandatory vaccines if the vaccine were helpful to public health. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What a great call. Thank you. First of all, I don't agree that the government couldn't ban cigarettes. Maybe it shouldn't, but it could. I think the government would have a right to ban cigarettes. Cigarettes do no good at all. They just kill people. They increase the cost to our health system dramatically. They increase the cost of insurance to everybody. And I don't know where John Stuart Mill would come down on that. Certainly, you would have the right to ban cigarette smoking in public, which has been done in many jurisdictions around the world. And you could ban it in a house which has children or in a house which has people who are involuntarily exposed to it. The question is, could you prevent a hermit who lives alone from smoking in his attic just because it's going to hurt him? John Stuart Mill would probably say no. The Constitution would probably permit it, although I think it would be a close question. I'm not sure how the Constitution would come out on that one. In terms of the vaccine, I think if it did have an impact on preventing the spread of the illness, under a case from the Supreme Court in 1905, I think it's Jacobson versus Massachusetts, the Supreme Court has certainly suggested that it would be permissible. It would be a case of first impression if the vaccine only helped the individual who was vaccinated and didn't help the spread of the disease. I hope we don't get to that. I hope the vaccine will have a double effect, that it will help people and it will also help the people who didn't take the vaccine. I saw today that Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel has said he would be the first person to take the vaccine to make a public demonstration. I heard that from other public officials in the United States as well. My friend, a great rabbi, Rabbi Avi Weiss, volunteered to be part of the study, basically to show his members of his community that he's prepared to take the vaccine. I certainly would be prepared to take it once it was adequately tested on people in my age range and with my prior conditions. I think good citizenship requires that we take a vaccine that could help prevent the spread of disease and basic common sense says we should take the vaccine if it's offered to us, even if it only helps us and doesn't help the spread of the disease. But this is something that we should have a great debate over. And we should have all these issues laid out. You've heard debates about this on television. You hear my position and callers on the Dirt Show. So keep calling in on this issue, because it's only going to become a more pressing issue as the vaccine becomes deliverable and available in the United States, as it apparently now is in parts of Great Britain and Russia and other parts of the world. Coming to a theater near you soon. Thanks. Our next call is from Eric.
Professor Dershowitz, this is Eric Williamson from Mississippi. I was listening to your most recent podcast, and you continue to talk about the Reverend Warnock in that race, and how that if Reverend Warnock were to win that race against Loeffler, that the Democrats would get control of the Senate. The issue is that there's two races in Georgia. In order for the Democrats to control the Senate and then for the vice president to have the deciding vote, they would have to win both of those races. Right. Now, as far-fetched as it seems, I don't believe that the Democrats will win both of them. And if the Republicans win even one of those races, they will get that 51st and deciding vote in the Senate. Just my comment or small bit of criticism that there's two races in Georgia that the Democrats have to win. They have to win both of them in order to maintain or to gain control of the Senate. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're absolutely right, of course. But they are running in tandem. Ossoff is urging people to vote for Warnock, and Warnock is urging people to vote for Ossoff. And they're both saying that they have to win both to control the Senate, and therefore you should vote for both of them. So it's very likely, at least the Democrats think, that they'll either both win or both lose, that there won't be a distinction drawn between the two Democratic candidates. I'm drawing that distinction. I am not opposing Ossoff. Everything from what I've seen is he's a decent young man. I'm taking no position on that. I generally don't take positions on Senate races in states that I don't live in or have any association with. I am taking a position only on the Warnock case, not because of my desire to see either side control the Senate. I'm a Democrat. I prefer to see the Democrats control the Senate. But I don't think that controlling the Senate at the cost of having a man in the Senate who is as anti-Israel, anti-American, and anti-basic values that I think I support and the people of Georgia support is worth it. And so I'm not urging that the vote be in tandem. I think people can vote for one Democratic senatorial candidate and vote for one Republican senatorial candidate. Be interesting to see if that happens. Be interesting to see if people split their votes based on who the person is rather than on what party they're from. Generally, in elections like this, people vote party line. Let's vote Democrat. Check. Check. Vote Republican. Check. Check. But here, some people will vote yes for Ossoff, no for Warnock. And it would be interesting if the Democrats won one seat and lost the Warnock seat. It would send a very strong message to the Democrats. Don't nominate people like Warnock. Don't nominate people who say you can't serve in the military with distinctions and honor God. Don't nominate people who support the outrageous statements of the Reverend Wright saying, goddamn America. Don't support Democratic candidates who argue that the Israelis shoot down innocent Palestinians unarmed like birds of prey. That's bigotry. That's a blood libel. Be careful who you nominate. Don't become a party of the hard left. Don't accept anti-Israel rhetoric as part of your party philosophy. That's a lesson that I think would be an important one for the Democrats, and that's a lesson that I support. So I appreciate your call. You're absolutely right. Democrats have to win both, but I think they're running in tandem in order to win both. And usually when you have a runoff like this, there are not a lot of cases to judge on, but when you look at parallel cases, either the Democrats win both or they lose both, or the Republicans win both or lose both. Here, because of Warnock, I think it's certainly possible we could see a split outcome, which would result in the Senate remaining in the hands of Republicans. But remember, when you say in the hands of the Republicans, there are still three or so Republicans, Romney and Smith and Karski from Alaska, who can't be always counted on to vote straight party line. So, yes, they would retain control of the Senate and they would name the majority leader of the Senate. The opposite would happen if the Democrats won both of those seats, even though there are two or three independents in the Senate. They vote with the Democrats, but you can't count on them on every vote. So you're going to get, even if you get the 50-50 split with the vice president casting the deciding vote for the Democrats, that will happen much of the time, maybe even most of the time, but probably not all of the time. Great call. Thanks for making the point that I think everybody should understand about the Democrats needing to win both seats in order to control the Senate. Our last call for today is from Bill in California.
This is Bill from California calling again. Here's a question unrelated to the election, which I hope you will find interesting. I am brand new to politics. I simply believe in whatever works, and I'm squarely in the middle class. As I research and experience the policies of the Democrats, whether in cities or states that they control, I see nothing but failure. If there are 100 homeless people in a city and the Democrats come to power, the next day there are 1,000 homeless people. If 5% of the population cannot afford housing or rent in a city and the Democrats come to power, the next day 50% of the population cannot afford housing or rent. If there are 100 crimes a day in a city and the Democrats come to power, the next day there are 1,000 crimes a day. Public schools are overcrowded and demand private donations. Healthcare, health insurance, higher education, utilities are all extremely expensive. Taxes and government fees rise exponentially with no end. And only the multitude of government workers, plus the very poor, appear to benefit. My question, what in your view is the absolute best, most successful, proven over and over again policy of the Democrats? Thank you.
That's an interesting question. It's more of a political commercial against the Democrats than a question, but I accept it. First of all, let me give you my experience. I've lived in three cities basically in my life, New York, the Boston area, Cambridge, and Miami Beach, all controlled by Democrats, all great cities, great, great cities. I wouldn't have changed my life in any of those cities. They're wonderful cities. One reason there's homelessness in great cities is because people are attracted to those cities. Why is there a lot of homelessness in Los Angeles and San Francisco? Because they're wonderful cities and they're warm, and people who have no money come to those cities. There is no homelessness in places where there are no services provided. That's not necessarily a good thing. So again, I don't want to use this show to promote the Democratic Party or to promote big city Democrats. Do I have criticisms of what went on in the Boston area and New York and Miami Beach? Sure. But they're great, great cities. And the description you give just doesn't fit. Look, I'm a New Deal Democrat. I believe that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, despite his flaws, and every great person has had deep flaws, Franklin Roosevelt among them, I think he presented what America should be like, a free market society, a capitalist society, to be sure, a society where people can make choices and rise from the lowest level to the highest level economically, but with safety nets, with Social Security, with Medicare and Medicaid, with a range of social services, with a compassionate immigration policy, which recognizes that people come to this great country because they know that their children will have a better future here. So it's not as simple as you present it. When you try to run a great city or a great state, there are going to be problems. There's no free lunch. And again, given the choice between living in my cities, the cities I've lived in, which were always controlled pretty much by Democrats. No, Rudy Giuliani was the mayor of New York, to be sure, and I think he was a great mayor when he was the mayor of New York. He really did bring down a crime in New York. But it's mixed, and Massachusetts now has a Republican governor who's very good, but generally Democrat mayors. Miami Beach has always had Democratic mayors and Democratic leaders. I pick those cities. Obviously, I pick those cities because that's where I've lived, over Republican-controlled cities, which are somewhat less generous, perhaps, to people who live there and less attractive to people who are poor. It's complicated, and it's very, very complex, and I don't think there's one clear answer, but I will remain a kind of an old New Deal Democrat until somebody comes along with a better solution. And as Winston Churchill once said about democracy, the worst form of government, except for all the others that have been tried over time, I do think liberal democracy, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, the way others have run our cities, may be the worst, except for all the others that have been tried over time. So I'm sticking with my politics, but I'm not trying to influence you on my politics. You pick your own politics. The goal of this show is, if you're a conservative, to make you a smarter conservative. If you're a liberal, to make you a smarter liberal, to give you opportunities to hear every point of view. So please, whatever your point of view, Republican, Democrat, Trump, anti-Trump, Biden, anti-Biden, I want to hear from you on The Dirt Show. So please call, please subscribe, please keep your call short, under a minute. Make your points, make them effectively. Let the increasing number of people who are tuning into this podcast hear your point of view, and let your voice be heard. Final pitch today. Today is the last day for me to ask you to call the White House and please email and ask them to save the life of this young man on death row, Mr. Bernard. You will be doing a great deal of good. The Talmud says, he who saves a single human life is as if they saved the world. You can help save the world. So please make that call today and tune in tomorrow and in future days to The Dirt Show. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.